Fed can just print more money out of thin air, but the government's always going to be in debt to the Fed. Oh.
Everybody has questions that aren't being answered.
What's up, guys? Doing this recording a little earlier than usual, so sorry if it sounds like there's a frog in my throat. But I had Chaz on yesterday. Wanted to get this episode out as soon as possible. We had a fun conversation, as always. And he was on today to talk a little bit about his newest book, and then also the Betts slash Neff Castle, as it's referred to, in Florida. And as you know, hopefully, Chaz does a lot of paranormal research, does a lot of ghost hunting, and he does it in a cool way. I actually really do enjoy how he does this stuff. It's not corny. It's not like the bullshit that you see on TV. He actually gets out there and does some really cool stuff and looks at it from a logical perspective. If something moves by the wind, he doesn't say, oh, that was for sure a ghost. And, you know, just he does a good job with what he does here. And I'm going to share with you from change.org the petition. It's in the bio here for the episode. Change.org. And it's Save the Betts slash Neff Historical House. Really easy to sign it. I signed it. He just started this petition. Only a couple supporters so far. And I did sign it. It's very easy. When it asks you to either donate or to share the thing, you don't even have to do either. You can skip both of those if you just want to simply sign. And that's what I did. I signed it. Didn't share it with anyone other than you guys. And I didn't donate. So it takes 2 seconds to go do. And it means a lot to some paranormal researchers out there. And if nothing else, if you're not into paranormal research, just history. I mean, this would be like the erasing of history if this thing were to go away. And we're supposed to be against that as a community. So here's a chance to make a little bit of a difference. And here is his new book. It's called A Place Between Time and Space, A True Story About Ghosts, UFOs, and Florida's Strangest Home. Really, really interesting. You can buy it for $6.66 on Kindle, and or you can get the actual physical book for $16, basically. Yeah, really good dude. Kind of obviously trolling a little bit with the price there. Some of you Christians out there might not enjoy that too much, but you know, he is a good guy, and I enjoy talking with him. We talked about a lot of shit here. We talked about some of the history of the house, and he gets into the ghost stories, which are very, very interesting, and then some really cool UFO stuff too. There's something with a weird metal sphere that that he talks about, and that was very, very interesting. I was kind of just like zoning in to what he was saying. I didn't really have much feedback on it. Really, really cool stuff. I hope that we can save this house. He's actually been in this place. It's kind of cool. So I haven't been there. Probably won't ever get to go there, but nonetheless, his videos on it are pretty darn interesting. It's on government land, so he had to like sneak in here, do some real cool shit in order to get the footage that he has. So I hope that you enjoyed this episode, a little bit different than the ones I do. You know, I don't touch too much on paranormal stuff, but why not? Got to mix it up every once in a while. And this one truly was fun, so I hope that you enjoy it. Hope that you'll support Chaz's work. He also has a website, chazofthedead.com. Writes a lot of cool articles. And just a real busy dude and real passionate about his work. So hope to see some support over on that petition. And just hope that you guys enjoy this episode. Here is Chaz from chazofthedead.com. Enjoy. All right, everybody. I've got Chaz here. You've heard him on my show actually a couple times at this point. We talked about bee theory, which was dope. Blew some people's minds. The levitation technology with the bees. And he runs chazofthedead.com, pretty cool little Instagram presence, and he's a TikToker,
as well, if I'm not mistaken. You're one of those kids that does TikTok, dude. So, I'm really
with those trends.
Yeah, you got to stay up to date with that stuff. I don't do it. I think that TikTok is 90% bots, personally. But I'm interested.
It definitely is. I see the usernames and shit that who follow me and whatnot. It's worse than Twitter when it comes to the bot shit. But
yeah,
hey man, people don't seem to mind.
Hell yeah, dude. Well, hey, you know, if you can grow your platform there, then I say go for it. You're getting into all kinds of different stuff. You're kind of pushing yourself when it comes to, you know, what you research and what you get into. I can tell that you're passionate about what we're about to talk about right now. And if I'm not mistaken, this is the Betts case is what it is. Yes,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. The Betts sphere. Yeah.
Okay. Well, before we get into that, man, why don't you plug all your stuff that you're working on, including this new book that talks about what you came across, and we'll run this like a Quentin Tarantino movie. You know, we'll get to the end and then we'll like describe how we got there. So plug away, dude.
Absolutely. So the book is A Place Between Time and Space. It's a true story of UFOs, ghosts, and Florida's strangest home. And it was kind of my quarantine project. You know, I like to travel around and do international research and, you know, places that typically haven't been investigated before. But like a lot of people, I found myself halting travel plans in the last couple years because shit got a little weird with visas and vaccines and all that. Instead I did some research here in the States. We did a cross-country road trip looking into all kinds of haunted locations and ghost lights. And on our way out of Florida on this road trip, one of the first stops was the Betts house, this famous house where this UFO story occurred. And this story occurred in the spring of 1974 is when the known story occurred. And this occurred on Fort George Island, where this house stands. And it is, it's an island with a lot of history, history dating back to thousands of years of native settlement. The Timucua tribe lived there for thousands of years. When you drive through the island, you see these shell middens just on the road. They're like, you know, almost like driving through a little valley, but it's these oyster shell mounds that were constructed. And then it was a place where a plantation was. It was an original plantation, but it was later bought by Zephaniah Kingsley, and it still has the Kingsley name. And he was a weird dude. He was into like polygamy and like African religions. He wasn't about Christianity. He didn't let his slaves practice Christianity. He was all about marrying multiple black women. And he was this weird character. He believed mixed race people were superior to both white and black people. Yeah, very bizarre kind of, speaking of Quentin Tarantino, like a fucking character.
What era is this in? So this is like during the slave times.
Yeah, so this 1800s. Was just pre-Civil War, 1800s. It was right when, actually, he owned the plantation right when the U.S. purchased Florida from Spain. And so he actually started his plantation under the Spanish system of slavery, which much more aligned to these beliefs, because mixed-race people under that system had more rights than, you know, the darker you were, basically, the less of a person you were, which was very fucked up, but much more mild compared to the U.S., where if you were even like, if you were a quarter black, you know, you're a slave. Yeah. That's how it is. And so when they had that transition, it was a rough one for him. There were all kinds of rebel groups that captured his plantation. He had a couple of them. They burned some of them down, and a super bizarre kind of moment of history, especially because despite him having these progressive ideas, he was still bringing in new slaves, even though the Atlantic slave trade had ended. There was one incident where there were some 300 slaves being transported. They got stopped by the U.S. Navy, because, you know, contraband, you're not allowed to bring any new slaves. You can trade the ones we have in country, but you can't bring in any new ones. So they stop this boat and they're like, well, where are you headed? They're like, Kingsley Plantation. And the Navy's like, well, shit, man, we don't have like beds or space or food for 300 slaves. So I guess go to Kingsley Plantation, but, you know, don't do this again. They gave him literally a slap on the wrist and let him have these 300 slaves because there was just no one else around Jacksonville at that time who could care for, you know, that kind of operation. So he was a weird dude. And this was around the time where weird stories and ghost stories kind of started to form on the island.
Well, and before we move too far ahead, you mentioned this. Is it the Timaquas, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know much about them? Because I've actually never heard of those guys. And I'm not the most, solidified when it comes to that kind of research. But you know anything? I mean, obviously, they're superstitious. They're a Native American tribe, right?
There's not too much actually known about them, unlike the Seminole and other Florida Indians who persisted longer into European settlement. The Timaqua, they were in North Florida, kind of into the Panhandle, South Georgia tribe. They traded with tribes from all the way in Mexico. They had this very established trade route. There's some known about, they're very little, but there's a little bit known about their religious beliefs. They similar to the Seminole, a lot of ancestor worship, you know, sacredness applied to certain animals. There was one of the very few well-recorded rituals was this one of black drink. They drink this really heavily caffeinated, like dark liquid out of a shell. And I forget the active ingredient, but it was basically like a quadruple espresso shot. And they would use this in rituals and things like that, in addition to your typical tobacco and other things. And interestingly, on the island, there is this hill, Mount Cornelia. And of course, Florida doesn't have a lot of hills. It's kind of a weird piece of land. And it's actually the highest point in Duval County in the whole surrounding area. And it's on that hill, you know, where this native settlement was surrounding for thousands of years, that they built the Betts house. And it was originally called the Neff House, and I prefer calling it the Betts Castle because it looks like a fucking castle, really.
Yeah, it's, you have some video of it up on your social media. It's pretty interesting, and it looks obviously like run down and like condemned almost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting you bring up that tribe. I was trying to do just a quick search. I couldn't find anything at all on them. It was just the thing that popped up was the Tonkawa, or the Tonkawa was what popped up, but not the one that you mentioned. So that's interesting.
So the Timaqua, I believe, is a Timucua or AU, something like that. But yeah, they weren't really well recorded. There was a Spanish mission on the island that kind of recorded some stuff, but you know how those missions be. They're not really worried about preserving the native cultures quite the
opposite. They rewrite,
so
that
there wasn't
shit.
there wasn't really a lot of effort or thought paid into preserving this tribe. And it wasn't like the Seminoles who, you know, a few hundred years later were waging the longest native war against the U.S. in history. But they had the similar tradition. You know, we know from the Middens that they lived on the coast, they ate shellfish, you know, they were a heavy fishing, hunting, gathering society. And yeah, it's certainly believed that this location, Mount Cornelia, because of its height, it might be partially midden, it might be created. There's been efforts to research it, but there hasn't really been a long-term project to investigate it.
But and so to be safe here, just to be clear, is it like safe to say that this is on like some haunted land?
Yeah, so that, yeah, absolutely. There's all kinds of ghost stories from various eras. So the first person to land there was Jean Ribault, a French explorer. And he landed on the island And it's actually credited as that island being the first place that a Protestant prayer was prayed in North America.
Oh, shit. Okay.
So already some kind of a cult significance apply to that, no matter what your beliefs are.
Very weird. And where's the island? I have a little map pulled up just for my own reference.
Jacksonville. We're north of Jacksonville here. Go zoom in. and yeah, stay right there at the mouth of the St. John's River. And you see Timaquan Ecological and Historic Preserve. So the island's within that preserve there. And it's owned by the national parks. It's not a national park, but it's a cultural park. If you go a little south from where you are there, it says Fort George Island. And so that's the island in question here.
So it's like a marshy land.
Yep. It's cornered by one by the river. Then it's got the Atlantic on one side on kind of this weird curve. And then it has, the three other sides are pretty much marsh wetlands.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And of course, I was actually just doing another show and they were talking about how a lot of native tribes of this time period, the burial rite would just be submerging someone in the marsh, just take their whole body and push them down into that really wet, loose mud, and it just sucks them down. Wow. And so, this island very much lives up to that cliche of a Native American burial site, right? It totally lives up to that. And that one's, I'm a skeptical of that entire idea.
Well, it's freaky to think, though, you know, because you think about the Southwest and you think about a lot of those areas that are, you know, more kind of, you know, rich with that kind of folklore. But it sounds like, I mean, this is a very interesting spot. So this area is where the first Protestant prayer is conducted, I guess. But continue with your story. It's very interesting. Yeah.
And so the Jean Ribault actually built a fort in this area. No one knows exactly where this fort was, but people assume it was on this Fort George Island. And it was wiped out. They were completely massacred by the Spanish, who had set up a settlement 45 miles to the south, St. Augustine. If the French had won that scrimmage, which they didn't even get close, that was very much a massacre. But if they had won that scrimmage, Fort George Island very well could be the oldest city in North America. So years later, they have a British fort there where it becomes called Fort George. The Americans occupy the fort for a while. They build this plantation you're seeing the pictures for now. And it becomes this really, you know, prosperous plantation until, of course, the end of slavery and the Civil War. And being the weird guy Zephaniah Kingsley is, he decides to move to Haiti and live down there and start a plantation. But ends up dying pretty shortly afterwards. He was a pretty old dude at this point. And one of his wives, Anna Kingsley, a black woman, she married him as like a child bride in this weird Senegalese, tradition with multiple polygamy. He had a bunch of wives, but she was number one. She was his bottom bitch. And the top lady. I'm getting a scoff from Kim that wasn't culturally sensitive.
Yeah, we know what a bottom bitch is. It's Kim's favorite chick, dude.
Yeah, she ran this plantation on her own, essentially. She was in charge of it while he was off doing business, working at his other plantations around Florida and in Haiti. She was quite an interesting figure. Again, there's a lot of these figures, it's hard to understand them now, right? We look back. And we have this very, you know, North versus South view of slavery and race relations and shit. It was weird. It was weird down there. And I think one of the ghost stories best encapsulates this complexity. And that's the story of Old Red Eyes. I swear I'm going to get to UFOs here in a second. But I got to set up the ghosts first.
Yeah.
Because this is a place of high strangeness. And it has been for a long time. And so the story of Old Red Eyes was a story told on this island, as kind of a folklore story. We're not really sure how much has been altered. But it was of this slave who was supposedly killing other slaves' children. He was the serial killer amongst the community. And the community got together, figured out who it was, and they lynched him. And, you know, okay, slaves lynching another slave. When I first read the story, I was like, that's totally a, you know, like a white guilt version of the story. But then I got to know and do the research on Zephaniah Kingsley and how he, his beliefs and how he ran his plantation. And he absolutely let the slaves conduct their own justice. They had working hours. They were allowed to have their own second jobs and they could buy their freedom. He totally had this weird system set up where he wasn't getting involved in things like that. So in this weird twist, it kind of turns out that this story potentially has some more truth to it. And it originates from the, well, the modern telling originates from a folklore book, but the tale is from the community that was living on that island in the 1900s. And that's when the island went over its next change. The early 1900s, the Gilded Age hits and the Gatsby era starts on Fort George Island. They build the Ribault Club, which is this fancy schmancy hangout for Jacksonville's elite. And they build a golf course on the island. The fields are gone and they build up this golf course. And this is during the time period where the Neff/Betts Castle gets built. And the man who commissions it is a man named Nettleton Neff. He's a railroad engineer. Quickly before I get into this one, Old Red Eyes, his ghost, he was lynched, but his pair of demonic red eyes is still seen on the island. And he was this local boogeyman for the people around this, the mouth of the St. John's River. If you saw
Red Eyes, Red Eyes is a slave, a slave's ghost.
Yeah, the slave serial killer, yeah, who was killed.
And that's his ghost.
That's his, supposedly, that's the old story. But this pair of red eyes is seen around the island, which, of course, if you know your paranormal stuff, that luminescent eyes is something that pops up a lot, right?
Yeah, like Mothman.
Yep.
Yeah, we said at the same time. Yeah, look at that. Freaking the chupacabras, dude. Mm-hmm. Like, it happens a lot. It
has luminous eyes a lot of cases, yeah.
What do you think that is, before we move on? Well, because I don't believe... we've talked about the paranormal stuff before, and you want to see more proof. This is what drives you out there because of the stories, and you're very research based. I don't believe in much of the stuff, right? And I know that you're out there trying to find proof yourself. What do you think that is? Because I don't doubt that people see this, and I don't think that it's environmental phenomena either. It's got to be something.
So I'm not quite sure what the red eyes is, but I am fascinated by it because that was my kind of initial experience that got me interested in the paranormal. And I don't know if I've ever been into this on this show. But when I was a kid, one night sleeping in bunk beds, I'm on the bottom bunk. I fall out of bed and there's a pair of red eyes, kind of like a Halloween graphic, flaming on the edges, you know, staring back at me from underneath the bed. And of course, I'm a kid. Maybe 8 or 9, I hop back in bed, throw the blanket over my head. I'm safe. Ride it out till the morning.
Yeah, that's base.
You know, no hands dangling over the edge, nothing like that. Next morning I wake up and, you know, I'm young, but I'm rational. And I start cleaning under the bed to look for anything electric, you know, a toy that had like a power light or anything red that could have, you know, explained what I saw. And my older brother was coming down the ladder, a couple years older than me, sees what I'm doing and asks me without prompting or anything, did you see the red eyes too? And the way he asked it, I still remember. Not a prank. He was fucking terrified. You know, he was freaked out. And he stayed freaked out. He really didn't. He's still kind of iffy on these paranormal things. For me, it was the opposite. I was fascinated. You know, at the very least, that was a shared dream. And what we know about our brains and science says that's impossible. So even the most rational explanation is still paranormal. And that was the moment where I was like, well, shit, paranormal shit is real.
Well, so how much older is your older brother than you?
He's 2, 3 years, 2.5, 2, I think.
Okay. And so he got very turned off by ghost stories and paranormal kind of activity.
Oh, yeah. For a while, he was very atheist. He was very, like, reality-based. And he still is. He's a chemist. He's a scientist. And so he's a little more open-minded now because he's a chemist. He's tried some chemicals that have opened his mind a little bit. But he, again, had this very rational, like, again, like, I'm out to debunk this thing. There's no such things as that. It must have been something else. And ironically, that's something you find a lot in the paranormal and in psychedelics, right? Someone takes a mushroom, they're either going to have this, whoa, like, I'm connected with the universe. Like, something higher exists and something magical is going on. Or they're going to be fucking terrified. And it's going to be the worst experience ever. It's also the reaction you get to people when they get abducted, right? Abducted by aliens. They're either terrified, taken in the middle of the night, butthole probed, worst experience ever. Yeah. 0 out of 5 stars. Or it's the opposite. It's, oh, well, yes, they took me, but, you know, I agreed to this in my past life, and we're all a cosmic
those are the worst together. People.
Space communism. Yeah, the whole Stephen Greer weird peace, love, and aliens stuff.
Well, let's spend a little bit of time on this, man, because you actually mix this in with your research. You mix psychedelics in with your research pretty heavily.
Absolutely. Too heavily.
Oh, sure.
I try to stay in reality as much as I can.
Yeah, no, not in like I don't mean that to sound like you're just getting out there getting high and looking for ghosts. So
I'm doing that too, so it's somewhere in between.
Okay, well then, so let's put it this way: you mix chemicals with research, right? And what do you think that does?
Well, it's let me put it this way. The research has led me to really look at these chemicals and substances as in a different light and see that there is a similarity between the psychedelic experience and the paranormal experience. And, you know, this isn't that groundbreaking of an idea. It's what a lot of skeptics use to debunk the whole thing. They say, oh, well, it was all in your head.
Sure.
There's clearly something else going on. You have people with implants. These UFOs are leaving burn marks. We're capturing them on camera now. They mutilate cattle. You know, even Bigfoot, he leaves footprints and he throws rocks. You have the same moving of objects in poltergeist cases. There's physical things occurring that are well, well documented throughout history.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there aren't some of these aspects that are consciousness related, that are hallucinatory in some way or another. And looking at the phenomenon really, and having a good amount of psychedelic experience, really shows those parallels. And that reaction's one of them. But you have other things more specific to the experience, the alteration of time, right? How many times do we hear missing time in UFOs, paranormal cases? I know a case of some teenagers using a Ouija board. They thought it was 30 minutes, but it was morning when they stopped using it.
Yeah, lost time.
And I've had those same exact things under psychedelics where I thought I was staring at that wall for 5 minutes, man, and 3 hours have passed. How is that possible? It's really a mind fuck. But it's something that pops up. You have the viewing of strange worlds. And again, the narrative, a lot of times these abductees, it sounds like they're describing a psychedelic experience. You know, the first time on a psychedelic, it's really hard to put into words, and it seems to be the same for a lot of these, you know, paranormal experiencers.
Sure.
So there is something going on with our consciousness and how it interacts with reality.
Well, do you think that the consciousness, whether it's a single person's consciousness or groups, and especially like in regard to like group hallucinations, do you think that these can leave behind like tangible evidence? Like, in other words, do you think that you can have a quote unquote hallucination, and then there's actually like solid evidence left behind that maybe something actually did visit you? If you hallucinate like an alien abduction, but then you do have a scar on your body, right? Do you think that it's possible that maybe you didn't get abducted, but for some reason you thought about it so hard that you actually do end up getting a scar?
Well, that would be the nocebo effect, where you believe it so hard, you have that negative health effect. And yeah, that seems to be well-documented phenomenon around the world with people in certain belief systems. You know, you hear the story of the witch doctor cursing someone, and even though there's nothing physiologically wrong with them, they die in a couple days because they believe the curse so much. And again, it's hard to say what exactly, where the line of, you know, oh, it's you willing it and it being real. And the truth is probably those things are real in some aspect, and we just don't understand them. There's this disconnect in reality between people that we clearly share a planet.
Sure.
But we don't necessarily share realities. And that's really what I think most people are experiencing today in modern times.
Yeah, it's like border science or pseudoscience or something, right? But I mean, there's this interesting story, and I mean, there's many stories similar to this. There's an obscene amount of women that are trafficked out of Nigeria through Italy and then to the rest of Europe through that whole train of people that comes through there. And in Italy, they see in like psychiatric hospitals and shit like that, and asylums and things, they see a lot of women that think that they have been controlled through black magic in order to be prostitutes, and they're trafficked, right? And they mm-hmm. feel a connection to their trafficker. And there's just wild stories of women getting completely better and then getting a package in the mail at the hospital, seeing something that comes in this package and then just losing all their progress. And then they snap mm-hmm. back into that, you know, more like kind of, I don't know, demonic state.
The symbolism really, and it has the same powers over us, though. We always point to those exotic religions because it matches the exoticism of the event, right? It's something so crazy and so foreign, we couldn't imagine it. But if you look at our country, man, we got dudes dancing with snakes in their hands in the name of Jesus.
Yeah.
And sometimes they get bit by those poisonous snakes and just don't die. It's been documented. Sometimes they do, which is a whole other thing. Many times they do, but sometimes they don't. And that's weird. And perhaps there is, again, it does seem like we create our own reality. And this is
when we're getting into snakes and stuff, there's such things as dry bites and stuff, you know, like sometimes snakes will bite and they don't inject
them. That's true,
right? So but I hear what you're saying. Like, if you believe something hard enough, it can happen. I mean, people can manifest cancer in their own body if they're scared of it enough, and on the other side, they can, you know, believe so hard in the cure that they remove their own tumors just by thought. Right.
And well, we know this ability, we've measured it scientifically before. Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove gets really into it, into his Encyclopedia of Consciousness, does all the numbers and boring stats. But basically, the root of it is you can influence a random number generator up to, on like your best day, 11%.
Yeah, 11.
If you're thinking even, you've got like an 11% chance to make it more likely to be even than odd. But they found that researching that is really fucking tricky, because if you get a bunch of dudes who don't believe in it, you'll actually have that 11% in the negative. If they're running the people running the experiments are out to debunk it, they'll have such of a negative effect they accidentally rebunk it in this weird way, and vice versa. If you have someone who believes in it, then it alters the test results. And so it's created this issue of, well, why haven't we studied ESP more? It's kind of impossible. It's the same wall they're hitting in quantum mechanics right now. We know particles don't exist unless they're observed. but we're observers. So what's the next step? How do you continue to investigate something when you're forcibly part of the equation? And the fact that we haven't is, I think understanding that is where the answer lies. There's this really good study done in Namibia, which I'm going, hopefully going there to do a paranormal case maybe in the next year or so.
What is this?
Namibia, South Africa. It's on the Atlantic coast, just north of South Africa. You've probably seen the pictures of like the sand dunes and those like ghost ships, like washed up in the desert. It's this region. And they did this study with the Kalahari Bushmen, these native people in the interior of the country living in this central semi-arid climate. And it's very simple tests. You can go online and do it now. And it's nine circles. All of them are green. One of them's blue. Clearly, that circle right there is blue. To you and I, clear as day, that one's blue. And they showed this graph to the Kalahari Bush people, and they were like 50-50. They were like, maybe it's that one. I'm not really sure. Maybe it's that one. They couldn't quite discern it. Then they showed them a second slide, nine circles again, all of them green. One of them is one shade different green, but I can't tell. I honestly cannot tell which one's different. It's such a slight change that most Westerners cannot pick out which circle's different. But to these Kalahari Bush people, oh, that one. Clearly that one. It's as easy as picking out the blue one is for us. And this is a super bizarre scenario. And it's something that's been studied in another scientific field across the world in China. There was a study done with the Terracotta Warriors and this thing called Hunan Purple, probably butchering that. But it's this essentially this seventh color that no longer exists. But it was painted on these warriors. And we know it was a paint, but we're like physically unable to perceive this color anymore. It's this really bizarre kind of mystery. And again, it gets into quantum mechanics and shit that I'm not going to pretend like I'm qualified enough to explain. But the reason those two examples are so good is because they are by people who are qualified enough to explain what's going on. And the explanation is, I don't know, something fucky. Essentially, right? There's this mystery that our reality, what we see, what we perceive and experience, it's definitely more malleable than we give it credit for. We live in this materialistic society and, you know, that thing's a thing and that's what it is. And what science and what paranormal research shows, especially, so that's not really the case, that there are these outliers, that reality isn't just, you know, a tape you can set your fucking clock to. Sometimes shit fucks up. It doesn't play smoothly. It's a game. It's not a perfect video game. There's glitches. And that's what these outliers are. And that's what we're science is beginning to study.
Yeah, that's very interesting, dude. It's just crazy to think like what's out that I'm still thinking about the idea and the reasoning of why you call them bush people of some kind.
It's the Kalahari Bushmen.
The Kalahari.
I think
Kalahari
bush people might be offensive.
Bushmen? Isn't that like kind of gendered? I mean, come on. I'm trying to.
Right. Hey, man. I don't know. I'm just. This is a secondhand thing I read here. You're getting it not from the source. So I'm sure there's a right term for all of this.
Well, yeah, I don't care if they get offended. It's fine. But I mean, you know, it's interesting that these people for some reason would see. Almost it's like they're seeing colors differently, and it's probably because of the programming when they were kids. There's got to be something involved with that.
Oh yeah, it definitely seems to be cultural. The culture definitely seems to have an element to it. It's kind of dependent, and that has definitely led me down a path with the paranormal. It's something I've noticed because I've been doing the conference circuit this year for the very first time. And it's something I've noticed specifically at Bigfoot conventions.
Dude, when's the last Bigfoot convention you've been to? That sounds like a blast.
I've been to a couple over this summer, a couple months ago. I've been to a few. And I gotta say, not any black people at these Bigfoot conventions. Not a lot of, I don't think there were any Hispanic people either. It's really a white dude, rural farming community phenomenon. And it's really interesting to think about when we apply this filter of, well, we have different cultures, different realities, different genetics to some degree, and we're seeing phenomenon differently.
Yeah, the Venn diagram of like Bigfoot convention people and then also people that voted for Trump is just one circle. There's not two circles in that at all.
Yeah, but that's probably pretty close. That's pretty spot on. Again, very interesting. And that's the thing I love about the paranormal, though, is because, you know, the people attending those conferences, whether they believe in Bigfoot or UFOs or ghosts, there's that extra willingness to believe. And like, I've never seen anyone be like shitty to someone at one of these conferences. Sure. You know, like there, it's always people getting along and stuff. Because it's weird, right? And you're finding this group of people who really understand that, yeah, weird shit absolutely happens. We're not going to look at you sideways. We're here. And, that's what I think these, I like going to, especially the general paranormal conferences, because then you see people. We went to one in West Virginia. And so it's West Virginia. I was thinking it was going to be a West Virginia crowd. And there were definitely a West Virginia crowd, but also tons of young people, queer people, people of all different colors, creeds, and nationalities. And, you know, again, who have experienced or are fascinated by these strange pieces, these strange artifacts in our physics. And it's cool to see, especially in a time where you can't really say that about a lot of subjects anymore. A lot of things are getting more and more divisive, while the paranormal, it seems we're moving forward towards a more unified understanding, because it's the time where you could say, oh, well, a ghost is a ghost and a UFO is an alien from a different planet and Bigfoot's just some kind of monkey living in the woods. Those days are gone. We know those things aren't true individually. Well, but we do know something's happening.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that in fringe communities, I mean, there's less fighting. And I wish that we could get that into society in some way, because, you know, like it or not, Bigfoot, that's a fringe community. The gun community is a fringe community, and you don't see any fighting at gun shows the same way that you don't see any fighting at Bigfoot conventions, right?
But that's fair. Slightly different. I bet there's probably some well-armed people at those Bigfoot conferences, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you know,
you might be onto something.
I think if people are armed, people don't necessarily want to fight over bullshit, right? It's different. Mm-hmm. But I mean, take that or like a Comic-Con. I don't know if there's many fights at Comic-Con type things either, because all these people are kind of bonded over their own beliefs, whether they be crazy or more like grounded in real shit.
I've seen some great Comic-Con breakups of couples in cosplay, like having huge fights
really
with each other. But you're right, I don't think I've ever seen anyone like duking it out, like because they're mad at, you know, like the Naruto fans versus the fucking Dragon Ball Z fans.
Yeah.
Or like, you're right, that's you're right.
Can food convention, I mean, you don't see many fights at conventions that are niche, so I wish that we could find that in our society. It just doesn't seem like we can. But let's get back into your specific story. Like the reason we always get on tangents here.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why I love coming on here, because you always get me going on some shit that I hadn't even really thought about before.
Well, yeah, I appreciate. It's always a fun chat, dude. And it's funny how we met, talking shit to each other on Instagram. Is how we actually.
Uh-huh. As all good friendships start.
I think that you said one of my posts was racist or something, I think.
Yeah, it might have been something about like Native American burial grounds being haunted or something.
No, it wasn't, but that's
some
a good segue.
Kind of weird theory.
So let's get into this then. So,
we were at 1920s, I believed, when I left off.
Back, right when we're getting into the whole house. Line.
Right. So, Haunted Island, from all kinds of ghostly women to old red eyes. If you want all the ghost stories, pick up the book. There's tons of them in there. Now we're going to start getting into the UFO stories. There's lots of those too.
Yes.
But first, there's one more ghost story. 1920s. Nettleton Neff, he's this railroad executive out of, I believe, St. Louis, Missouri. Chicago? From Chicago. I'm getting advice from my assistant
Oh,
over
nice.
here. So he was a railroad executive, engineer, top brass, and he wanted a vacation home in Jacksonville. And he was a member at this Ribault Club, right? This fancy schmancy Gatsby hangout golf course deal. And at this club, there was another man who designed and built the club. His name was Melvin Greeley. He was the Dean of Jacksonville Architects, right? And this was still back in the time where architect was like the fanciest fucking rich guy job you could have. They weren't just throwing up concrete squares and glass triangles and shit. They were really building some stuff. And so Nettleton Neff came to him with this set of like rough drawings that he drew up and said, "Hey, I wanna buy the land on this hill here on this island and build this house." And Melvin Greeley saw those and he's like, "All right, I can do that, but you know what? These have inspired me. I'm gonna draw my own blueprints for this hill. I love this location. I love your vision, but I think this is the house that you should build on this hill." And he was like, "Hell yeah, that's the one." And it is. It's this castle structure. This three-story conical tower is the entrance. It looks like, this big turret from a castle. It has this grand hall. I believe it has seven fireplaces. When it was fully built, some of the wings have collapsed and some of the fireplaces with it. But it had 17 different levels. It was three stories in a basement, but there were all kinds of weird step ups and step downs, shifting. It's really bizarre. The doors in the middle of the wall, 6 feet up. It's kind of like the Winchester Mystery
I
House,
was
if you're
gonna say
familiar
that,
with
but I
that
didn't
one.
want to sound like a basic bitch. Like, oh, it's kind of
No,
like a
it's a smaller version of that. It's kind of like a more compact version. It's bizarre.
Is there like
Melvin
hallways that
Greeley.
just lead into like nowhere, like a hallway with a dead end, or does it not go that far?
Not quite that. It's more, there's some weird door placements and weird, and so there are some kind of weird hallway cutoff things, but it's hard to tell what's was weird design and what was because of the collapses, the third wing collapse. There was a third wing built on later on, and then that one was tore down. Jerry Betts, who discovered the sphere, actually built that. She added another tower, but they ended up tearing all that down. And so there are these weird pieces of the house that don't make any sense, and it might be because there was something there at some point. But he builds this house for Nettleton Neff, and again, it's this Tudor style castle. It looks like it should be in Bavaria, not in the swamps and some hill in Florida. But the Neffs never get the chance to move in. The family gets struck with these tragedies right after the house is built. Their boxes are sitting in the house, but they never get the chance to arrive. First, Nettleton's wife dies in a fire at one of their other properties, a fire that the newspapers called mysterious. Then their adult son commits suicide. He vanishes from Harvard for 2 weeks and they find him dead in an apple orchard. Supposedly, he shot himself. Where did he hang himself? Shit.
Maybe both. Did he know the Clintons?
He shot himself with his non-dominant hand, and he hung himself. He was Hillary Clinton's lawyer for 4 years. But Nettleton Neff, he killed himself as well in his office one day. The guy in the next office heard a shot ring out. They kicked down his door, and he had shot himself. And so the family never moved into this house. And of course, the Great Depression hit right after the house was built as well. And so the Ribault Club fell into decline. The golf course was just abandoned. It turned very quickly into Florida swamp. Like the green swallows it real quick. And when you walk around the island today, you would have never known there was a golf course there. You might see like a patch of sand every once in a while, like this really white sand, and you don't even think of it because it's Florida. There's sand everywhere, but that's the remnants of a sand trap of what used to be this golf course. And this house sat empty on this hill. As the woods got thicker, people started telling stories. And, oh, old Red Eyes, he lives in the house now. And they would see these lights. They would hear organ music and telephones ringing out, even though there's never been an organ in the house. There's telephone wasn't connected. Didn't stop people from experiencing this ghostly phenomenon. And it sat that way for nearly 50 years until Jerry Betts heard about this weird spooky house in the middle of the woods and was like, hell yeah, I'm gonna buy it. And she's a character. She's still around. You can buy her paintings, though she does not talk about the case. Don't harass her about it. She's not into the UFO aspects. And we'll get into why that is. But she was a really powerful businesswoman, and in the 70s it was a hard thing to be. She owned a real estate company and a trucking company. She married her second husband was a naval engineer at Mayport Station, just to the south of the island. And so they moved into this spooky house after she heard about it. They were like, oh, she was talking about funding some kind of film project. And they were like, well, we could use that spooky house out on Fort George Island. And she's like, what spooky house? And she saw it and she fell in love and she bought the place, renovated it, added a new wing. And she lived there with four of her children running her businesses until one day her adult son, Terry, was walking around the island. Some versions of the story, she was with him. And they found this metal sphere. And again, all of the story gets murky. It got so murky at the time it was reported, and then it was retold so many times that there's several different versions about how all of this went down. One version was that there was this fire that was started in the woods by around this sphere, and that's what drew their attention. but they found this sphere and thinking it was something of historical significance, maybe a cannonball, you know, they're on this historic island. They brought it home and it sat in Terry's room for 2 weeks, just as this mundane sphere, until he started playing guitar in his room one day and the sphere started to vibrate and whistle. Ooh. And soon afterwards, it started to move around on its own accord, and follow people around. And it seemed to move with this intelligence, almost like a pet.
Like it would float or it'd roll?
It was rolling. It was rolling on the ground. And it would roll around this house.
You said cannonball, about 4 inches in diameter, 6 inches in
diameter. Oh, no, larger. I think it was like 22 inches in diameter. It was about 2 feet. This sphere, you know, initially they just started telling their neighbors and like, hey, come over and look at this fucking thing. This is weird. And soon it hit the local media. Local TV station showed up. Local radio guy, Ron Kravitz, he was kind of like the local coast to coast. He did the late night paranormal radio show
back in the 70s.
Yeah, when terrestrial radio was the thing. Okay. So he showed up to the house and he actually gave an interview recently with journalist Lindsay Kilbride. She does a great show on called Oddball. It's 5 episodes. It's about this case. Where she looks into it from the, like, is it real, is it fake kind of journalistic perspective. but he, in that interview, he described what he saw. He went over to the house, and, you know, the house is this weird castle. So he wanted to go outside and take more pictures of it. And as they went to go out, walk outside, the ball was sitting in the middle of the table. And it rolled to the edge of the table and dangled off the edge in this gravity-defying way. Like it was over it, just touching the corner and like kind of floating there. And it was wobbling at them like, hey, don't forget me. I want to go outside again, kind of like a pet, like a cat or something would, you know, trying to get your attention. And yeah, he still remembers to this day seeing that and being like, oh shit, that was fucking weird. And so soon the national media gets hears about this, and they start, you know, wanting to interview and investigate. The National Enquirer has this UFO panel set up. Dr. J. Allen Hynek, this father of ufology, many consider him to be, he got involved. He investigated the sphere several times. The Navy got involved because they have that naval station right to the south. They conducted their own X-rays. And officially in the media, they said, oh, the sphere is nothing. It's a mundane, just empty metal sphere. But that was after they had told the Betts family that it was, no, there's something weird inside this sphere. And before she had handed it over, Jerry Betts made them sign a contract that if it wasn't Navy technology, they had to give it back. And they were like, there's something going on. We need this. We're going to keep it. And she like was ready to go full legal team at them. And she was like, no, I'm not giving it back to you. I'm going to keep this sphere. And, so they released this statement saying, ah, no, it's nothing. And then in the media, they said, mystery sphere debunked. It was actually from a paper mill, this big metal sphere from a paper mill. They even found a guy who used to own one, and they take pictures with it. And they're like, yep, same thing. No explanation to why it was moving on its own, but yeah, that's what they say it is. And the story kind of dies off. And at that point, Jerry Betts had welcomed it, because the sphere had only caused chaos in her life, right? She was this prominent businesswoman, and now she was getting legal threats from the Navy. She was having UFO investigators show up at her door in the middle of the night, like these real crackpot kind of characters just ringing the house all hours. You know, it made it impossible for her to take business calls because she kept getting UFO calls. Even when she... they started to even have some weird kind of like Men in Black, John Keel stuff. Mm-hmm. When Terry took the sphere to New Orleans to this National Enquirer panel, they got this phone call from Jacksonville saying there was an emergency and that Terry had to fly back immediately. And when they did so, they got home and Jerry's like, what are you talking about? There's no emergency. Not like nothing's going on. Like nothing's wrong. And they thought that it was maybe the UFO panel fucking with them, trying to separate them from the sphere and stuff like that. And the family was really pissed off. J. Allen Hynek actually visited them at the home afterwards and kind of apologized and, you know, really, you know, made face and or saved face and, you know, healed these relationships and had the sphere tested in different private labs and stuff like that. But Jerry was pissed by this because she thought, you know, they were fucking with her. What she didn't know at that time, and no one knew at that time, was that unless they had just bought the Mothman prophecies, which came out that year, that kind of shit was happening all the time in those kind of high strangeness cases. People were calling John Keel's witnesses and imitating their voices, his voice. And so much so that there were even doppelgangers where people were like, no, I saw you and we had this conversation. And John Keel was like, no, I was in a different place at that time. Like, I have people who were with me who can vouch that no way that conversation happened, and weird things like that. Mm. So the high strangeness and the publicity and, you know, people calling her a crackpot and stuff, she was done with it. And so when the media debunked it, she was like, cool, yeah, I'm not talking about it anymore. I'm done. I'm done with this story. That's it. And a few years later, she moved out of the house. I'm not exactly sure what the reasons were. Before the whole sphere thing, though, there was an article from her describing living in a haunted house. They were experiencing all kinds of ghostly phenomenon before the sphere even showed up. Which, again, another interesting detail that no one in the UFO world ever talks about, right? The UFO guys are, oh, it's a metal sphere, moved on its own, must be a UFO. But there's this whole other case. The paranormal people call it the Neff House. You have the Betts case and the Neff House case, two different spheres investigating these two different concepts, when it's the same place, same story.
They're clearly, that's really interesting. Connected. Makes it confusing.
Right. And so the Betts Castle, as I prefer to call it now, it's the story of both of these things, of a haunted house, of a strange castle, of this weird metal sphere. But most interestingly, the story did not end in the 70s. And this was one of the reasons I really decided to investigate this house multiple times and return and try out these weird ghost code technology. I did a lot of weird stuff in these investigations. And this was the hook that convinced me something was still going on. Because everyone knows those now famous Navy videos that were released in 2019, filmed in 2015. One in
The UFOs.
2004, right? The Navy UFO videos, right? You have that gimbal one of the saucer, that black and white saucer rotating. It's kind of become the face of the UFO evidence, right? It's considered the best piece. But filmed on that same day by that same crew is the Go Fast video, which shows a metal sphere right above the water, and it's hauling ass. It's going real, real fast. But what no one seems to mention, brings up in this entire investigation, right? Most famous videos is that where that's filmed is only a few miles off the coast of Fort George Island. And that sphere, by what it looks like in the camera directions, is heading towards that island where 40 years ago, this family found a metal sphere, roughly the same size, that moved on its own.
So this thing's trying to get back to its home or something.
It's seemingly repeating some kind of phenomenon. It's on some kind of cycle, it would appear. And what's really interesting is, again, the crew that filmed that, they were running training missions off of the airship carrier, aircraft carrier, the Roosevelt, but they were stationed at Mayport Station outside of Jacksonville. And that's, again, the same station that investigated one of those spheres hands-on in the 70s. And what I uncovered through my research, which they didn't know about in the 70s, J. Allen Hynek, none of the other people involved in this story, was that in the 50s, that Mayport station was buzzed by a UFO. It actually had two prior UFO incidents before they investigated this Betts sphere. And so this station was already on alert on some weird stuff. You know, there's always the why didn't they spend time investigating this weird metal sphere? Well, it was next door. It was right north of the island. Her husband kind of works. He was a contractor that worked with the Navy. Maybe he set it up. No. The station was interested. They have this interest in UFOs because they directly experienced it. They got one hands-on in the 70s. And so when you consider those facts that they've had these continued experiences, the filming of those videos in 2015, the filming of that sphere starts to feel like a pretty weird coincidence. There's certainly something, they certainly know a little more than what they're letting on. And of course, that's no big revelation here. Everyone, I'm sure, listening to the show believes the government's lying about UFOs in some aspect, one way or another.
Not the
But
audience of this show, but yeah, I find
but
it just, I mean, just the coincidence alone that the man that had he was the husband of the woman that found the sphere in the first place, right? Said that, they wrote up a contract that this thing had to be given back if it wasn't Navy technology. And then the Navy ends up having footage of this thing later. That to me is very interesting alone. And then you're adding all this stuff on top of that. It is a hell of a coincidence.
Well, and so again, the story is really blurry. What we do know by the end of that month is that Jerry was telling close friends of the family that the sphere had been altered, that someone had fucked with it in some way. And that's my words, not hers. Said,
And
I'm
like this is
sure
a
she could have
living
used.
thing almost.
Yeah, she said it wasn't acting the same way anymore. It wasn't
Oh,
doing
wow.
the same stuff that someone, whether it was the Navy or whether it was J. Allen Hynek, and there's even this whole theory that Hynek stole the sphere. There's this story that he stayed at the house and they found him fucking with it in the middle of the night And then like he like swapped it out with a bowling ball, like Indiana Jones.
No fucking like, way.
He has the sphere, or his family has the sphere. And this actually comes from an interview his son gave. And it was kind of this innocuous thing where they asked Hynek's son, well, what do you remember about, you know, living in a house where your dad was, you know, Fox Mulder investigating UFOs?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, there was a lot of weird stuff around the house. I remember kicking around this metal sphere in the basement from Florida that was supposedly a UFO and da 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 da. So that's where this, again, no one's exactly sure what happened.
It reminds me of the Lochnar from Heavy Metal. That movie, Heavy Metal.
Oh yeah, yeah, kind of, yeah. That well, the spherical archetype definitely pervades.
It's like a glowing green thing, but just like how it's got this power to it, and why someone would want to switch it out. You know, it must have some sort of like either technology or some kind of power behind it.
Yeah, and again, these spheres are certainly something that is a real aspect of the phenomenon, whether it's videos from pilots, or it's something you can go see yourself. I went to, during that cross country road trip, we went to a couple locations where you can supposedly see ghost lights. Brown Mountain, I didn't get to see one, but my lovely partner Kim, she saw one of these weird light orbs floating out of the trees. Marfa, Texas, they have the Marfa Lights Viewing Center, and you can go out there and watch these spheres just flying around. And the old legend is that there are the lanterns or the ghost campfires of Apaches. Obviously nowadays it has all this UFO lore, and the people who live out there, they have these stories that are, it doesn't happen often, but it happens where these spheres show intelligence. There was one guy out there telling the crowd of people when we were there that he was in a school bus as a kid in this area driving down the road, and one of these lights went right up to the side of the school bus and went up and down the row of the school bus, almost like looking into it and inspecting it in a way, and then flying off. Again, showing this intelligence, but not like a supreme alien intelligence, almost like a childish pet-like, animal-like intelligence, just curiosity, observance. And then whoop, off it went. And so these spheres, it's one of these commonalities through the phenomenon that pops up over and over again. It's one that definitely deserves some attention. The sphere, the light sphere, might be that base point before you throw your cultural filter, like we were talking about before, before it becomes a Bigfoot, before it becomes a UFO, before it becomes a ghost of a Civil War soldier. It's that sphere.
Yeah, I didn't know. It's incredibly interesting to me so far. It's just, and I mean, this isn't even, so are there things that are kind of like seen over the area? Or is this the like, because this sounds like the foundation of the UFO stuff. Does it expand from here?
Oh, well, the UFO stuff, absolutely. They're in that region. There's, again, the encounters at the naval station just to the south. But that whole nature preserve area, that's kind of like the first patch of emptiness outside of Jacksonville. Jacksonville is a huge metropolitan area. It's actually the worst urbanly sprawled city. It's the biggest city by urban area in the U.S. because it's the worst planned city in the fucking country. It's horrible to drive through. Jacksonville's rough.
Jaguar, I've never been there.
Everything about it is, it's fun. I'm kidding. I love Jacksonville. I spent my summers there as a kid. But it's got its ups and downs, let's say that.
I've only been to Daytona in Florida.
Well, then Jacksonville might seem pretty nice.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. Florida shit talk. You know, go Sarasota. That's hometown.
Well, yeah, you live there, right? Are you still
No,
there
not yet? Anymore. Too expensive. Ever since the MTV show, they priced us out.
Ah, shit. Okay.
But anyways, that region, it's kind of like the first like remote, it's swamps, it's state park land. And when people are coastal and when people are driving those highways, they see some weird shit in the skies. There's a lot of black triangle UFO sightings. And that's the, what's the T3B6?
That's stealth.
That's yeah, there's that, that blueprint out there. That might have been a Star Wars ship I just said, but there's a blueprint with a name on it that describes it.
Well, and who knows how real that is? Because we have one of those kinds of things. There's a big one out here in Arizona that kind of ties in with the Superstition Mountains a little bit, but it's the Phoenix Lights, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same exact thing. It's that triangular, a big light. And dude, that the blueprint of that ship is very interesting, to say the least.
It's quite interesting. But I think on one of the previous shows, we definitely talked about this one before. But I saw a black triangle once. Still the best UFO sighting I've ever had. Everything else might have been something else, you know. Can't 100% say that was a UFO. That was a UFO. That black triangle, fuck me, man. That's clearly not a normal piece of known technology. But it was after doing these Ouija board mushroom seances for a month. And I was hanging out, not actively tripping. This was days after my last seance, hanging out with a friend, talking about these experiments. And he was like, oh, yeah, sure, dude. UFOs, Ouija boards, mushrooms, whatever, man. And almost ironically, it really seemed to be intentional, almost, this craft hovered over. Or perhaps it wasn't. Perhaps just having that conversation had altered our consciousness enough where the fucking cloaking wasn't working. Normally they're fucking cloaked and they just don't exist because we can't see that color or whatever. But having the conversation,
that's interesting.
Having the microdosed amount of substances in our system, whatever it was, allowed us to witness that.
And just a true openness to acknowledging that could be up there, right?
I mean, right. And again, I'm not sure. I can't say that's what happened. I'm not going to pretend like that's, yes, I got a psychic message and that's the truth. I don't know. But I have to say that's the best UFO sighting I've ever had. And those are some pretty high strangeness circumstances. It's not like I went out to Area 51 and I saw it take off from a fucking airstrip.
Sure. You know? Coming up from a mountain and shit.
Right, that would be awesome. Then I could say, okay, well, humans built that. Cool. Mm-hmm. Boom. Case closed.
Sure.
But no, it was in these weird circumstances. And again, this area around this island, people see these triangles. They pop up. For whatever reason, the filter's gone. And they can be seen.
Yeah, man, it's fucking crazy. It's very, very interesting. So when you go out to this house, when you go and you do your investigating, what are you like? What kind of stuff are you seeing, or like what kind of energies are you picking up? I've seen you make some videos, and obviously, I don't know if we talked about it on here or if you want to talk about like the land that it's on. Did we mention that while we were recording?
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about that. Yeah, again, it's on that highest hill. It's literally the house on Haunted Hill. Like it's all of the cliches you could think of.
But I was talking about how it's behind like on the type of land that it's on. I didn't know if you wanted to mention that.
Oh yeah, and the aspect of the marshlands.
No, the government land. I can edit this out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. No, I've written them a letter.
Okay.
Saying, hey, yeah, I snuck into the house. Don't sue me and maybe save it. If you're like gonna come after me, you save the money and like put it towards the house, essentially. Sure. Is what I'm saying. And for everyone listening to this episode, in the description there'll be a link to a petition to sign to help save this house, and that's the main goal I want to accomplish with this project. Sure, pick up the book if you want to hear all the weird, spooky stuff that happened in the house. I'm not going to give away too much.
Okay.
If you want to hear all the details, pick up the book. But definitely, even if it's the only thing you do today, please, please sign that petition to get the house recognized as a historic landmark. Again, built by the area's most famous architect, that already is enough to make it a historic landmark.
Sure.
Without all the crazy stories attached to it. So let's get this done. Bipartisan, no political movement attached to this. Sure. If you like spooky stories, or even if you just like history, please sign the petition.
Yeah, I can't imagine any kind of political implications that would be involved in just like trying to save a historic landmark. It sure seems historical, for sure. Now, why is the government trying to bring this house down? Like, what's the purpose? Or because there's nothing that they can fucking build out there. It's a marsh.
Well, it doesn't seem like they're trying to destroy it. It's more like it's fallen in between the cracks of fucking bureaucracy. You know, I tried to get a statement from them on the house, and no one seems to know who's in charge of maintaining it. I got like, because there's a couple different parks in this area, and overall the area is managed by the national parks, but the state parks have their own parks within the national park. And so no one really knows, my impression. They gave me an email address in Tallahassee eventually, and no one ever got back to me. So there's no thought to it. And it's not that it's being demolished by them. It's being demolished by the Florida swamp. It's being swallowed. Wow. And
that's creepy in itself. It's like being swallowed by the land.
And well, that's to answer your question is, why did I pick this project? It's because I went out there, and it's one of those places where I'm not psychic or anything like that, but you know, I trust my gut. I got pretty good instincts. Yeah, there's very few places I can count on. I've been to a lot of haunted places all over the globe, North and South America. I can probably count on one hand the places that I've been to, and I'm like, oh no, this is fucking weird. This is a weird one, you know, where like it just genuinely feels like it. And that was one of those places.
Well, obviously, we're focusing on this one here today, but can you name like a couple other ones that were really interesting, just in case people want to look it up?
So another one that's accessible here in North America, there's the Silver Run Tunnel in West Virginia. And West Virginia's got a lot of great haunted locations, asylums, hotels, Mothman Museum, all that stuff. Great place. But the Silver Run Tunnel / Tunnel 19... it's outside of this weird town called Cairo, which is built into this cliffside. It's the whole town is a couple blocks, big old Freemason lodge, and pretty much a bunch of empty buildings. And it's the town is eerie. And then this tunnel, it's in the middle of nowhere. It really is the deep woods in the mountains. And it's this long bending tunnel, pitch black. Where, oof, I don't know, man. That's a weird one. And so that's the tricky. Story is a good story. It's a really good story, which all these places tend to have. So it used to be a train tunnel. Now it's like a horse, part of like a horse trail. If you want to ride your horse through West Virginia, you can go through this trail, but you're going to have to go through this haunted tunnel. And back when it was a train track, they were riding through it. One night, the engineer saw this woman in a white dress standing on the tracks inside this tunnel, and it was too late. They were coming around the curve. It was too late to slow down, and they plowed right through her. Well, they stop the train, they get out, and they search up and down the tunnel. There's nothing, no bodies. And so the rumor of the ghost woman of Tunnel 19 starts spreading through the tracks. You know, the railroad people, that are like kind of like sailors, superstitious, right? And there was this one dude who was like, nah, I'm not afraid of any ghosts. No problem. I'll run this route. And he's going through, and sure enough, he gets to the tunnel. There's the woman in the white dress, and he plows right through her, keeps going, blows through the next couple checkpoints. And when he gets to the next station, they're desperately flagging him down, and he stops. And there's a woman stuck in his cow catcher. She had been a physical woman, and it's this weird kind of like future premonition.
Oh, wow.
You know, this weird ghost of the future. And I love bizarre stories like that. There's one from a house in Mexico City. It's this really weird house. It's painted all black. It's got this weird moon on the side, and the story's kind of got this weird similarity to it. where this kid snuck into it when it was abandoned one time. And in this top room, he saw the ghost of this man floating, like broken neck, hanging, his feet not touching the ground. Really classic horror movie kind of ghost floating in this room. Freaked him out, traumatized him. And then years later, he snuck back into the house and hung himself in that exact same room. And he had drawn all these pictures that ended up resembling of the ghost he saw, but it resembled his hanging corpse to the people who found him. So again, weird story. Good story.
It's a fun one house, though.
I love, it's a good twist on your classic. I hate a, and there was a guy in the Civil War and he died here. So he's still hanging out. Like those ones don't do much for me.
Yeah. Those are like that.
That's a good fucking story. And I think it's really, it more encapsulates when a story has that element. Again, I don't know how true that Silver Run story. That's the it's the story. Who it doesn't sound true. I can say that much. You know what I mean? It sounds really good. It's a great story. Doesn't necessarily sound true, but the stuff it it suggests the that weird alteration of time. You know, there's these core things. What creates a spooky story? Why did they come up with a story at this location? Well, it's weird. And it's not weird like, ooh, there's a ghost here. It's weird like it's a liminal space. That's the terminology we use nowadays, and I love it. I'm all here for it. It's a liminal space. It's something off. It, reality in this spot, for some reason, tends to fluctuate more often than not. And that's what those kinds of stories, you know, they tell us about an area, and those areas, they tend to be, again, when you show up to them, and because I'm skeptical, but when you show up to a place like this house on Fort George Island or that tunnel in West Virginia, it there's something to it, you feel that liminal feel. It has that sensation about it, you know, as compared to any of the like haunted places in St. Augustine, where really cool building, really great history, interesting, historic, but it doesn't, you know, you're not walking in there and expecting to see a ghost, right? Sure. Some of these it feels like that.
Have you been to the Superstition Mountains out here in Arizona?
No, I really want to. I wrote a great article about machete wielding men in black, which took place in the Superstition Mountains. It's on my bucket list of places to go hang out.
I'd really like to get out there too. We watched a mockumentary, you know, those Blair Witch Project style things.
Oh yeah, the best.
Dude, I love those so much. I want to make one day. It's like a goal of mine to make one.
Oh, I made one as a kid. It's gone. No one can find it. It doesn't
exist. Oh fuck.
Anymore. But I made one as a kid and it was pretty good. It was around this like pharmaceutical trial. It was really well thought out.
Really? Damn, that's pretty dope, dude.
Pretty good.
I'd love to make one, man, like, and put some effort into it, like get like a cast and all that kind of stuff, but it would be kind of fun to do one in a setting like that, because I mean there's a cave out there that's pretty interesting. Supposedly you can't take any rocks or anything from there or you'll get cursed. And Kim, I you know, date a girl named Kim too. And she, I guess as a kid, she took a rock from there, and she had a rough childhood, dude, very rough childhood. And it started relatively soon after this. And so she's a full believer in this, idea where like, whether it's a piece of gold that you find out there, whether it's a rock, whether it's a nail from a railroad or something from the mine, do not take anything from there.
It's cursed.
Or you get cursed, yeah. And I think that's very interesting. And, you know, I know someone firsthand that believes in it through experience. So, yeah, dude, I'm not big into this kind of ghost stuff, but there's some really cool stuff out here in Arizona that seems to be, like Jerome is an interesting city.
Well, and that's why the Superstition Mountains, though, seem to be one of those locations where it's not just ghost stories. You have all your, like, Lost Dutchman's mine. And
That's it. The Lost Dutchman, yeah.
But you also have all the weird UFO shit. The, like I was saying, the Men in Black story. That one's a great one.
The Phoenix Lights go through there too.
Yeah. So this dude, God, I can't remember his name. He was Maddox something like that. He was actually a Hollow Earth guy, and he was trying to find Hollow Earth entrances. Like, he thought, like, the Lost Dutchman mine was like an elevator to, you know, the hidden Shangri-La. And he was doing all kinds of weird research, and he thought the UFOs were coming from you know, inside the mountain and things as well.
In Arizona?
In the Superstition Mountains. And he was up in the mountains one day driving up this trail, and I'd really love to find the trail. I'd love to trace his route on this. And he was looking for one of these entrances with his adult son, and they were parked in this car watching a UFO over the mountaintop, and these two dudes with machetes walked out of the woods, like middle of nowhere, like, again, on the mountains, not even the woods, because you know that terrain, it's deserty, rocky stuff. They just walk up this hill, these two dudes, shirtless, wearing machetes. And why they're men in black, they had black pants and they got into a black car, so they're still men in black. But like, they were like, what the fuck's up with these guys? And like, they were clearly walking towards them, and they were like getting freaked out. So they drove down this trail back to the main highway, and then they like parked and they saw this. And again, they were up there. There was no other cars or anything. These two dudes walked out of the middle of nowhere. But then after they pulled down to the highway, they stopped and they see this black car coming back, and the two dudes pull up next to them. They get out of this car again with their machetes and start walking towards their car. And so they book it. They book it down the highway. And they eventually stop at this gas station and like park around back and like go inside and like have a sandwich. And they're like watching out the window, and they see this black car cruise down the highway. And they lost him. And he later would go on to write that he believed there was a tribe of like Native Americans who kept the entrances guarded, and that must have been who it was, and like, that's, you know, they were keeping the secret entrance to Agartha, you know,
that's
protected with their machetes. Really interesting story.
Isn't the story, I think it's a Christian story where it says that like there's three passages to hell. And I think hell could be Agartha. It could be like Hollow Earth, or just kind of disguising as that. But there's an entrance to hell through the bottom of the sea and in the middle of the desert. And then also one in the center of Israel, they say. So I think that would be kind of interesting. If
who said that one. Last one? Palestinians?
No. Jewish people did. Jewish people made that up. Yeah.
Is that why they need the Holy Land? They're guarding it.
I who fucking knows, dude? Have you seen that movie? Because I since you love these mockumentaries, I'm trying to find if I can get an answer from Kim what the Superstition Mountain movie is.
Yeah, I'd love to watch. I'll watch it tonight. Because
My
Kim loves those kind of, that's her favorite kind of horror movie.
Oh, me too. So, hands down, dude. I feel like the four of us could have a great movie night with a little bit of booze and some weed or something.
Hell yeah, dude.
But no, I'll get it. I'll call her if I have to right now. I texted her. But in the meantime, watch Israel. It's called Israel, spelled with a Z. Or no, I'm sorry, Jerusalem, spelled with a Z.
Jerusalem, okay.
It's the same kind of concept, but it's got like the Nephilim involved. It is a mockumentary. It's filmed through a girl's Google glasses. Her dad got her Google glasses.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's great, dude. So yeah, if you're writing it down, dude, I recommend you fucking watch that shit. Jerusalem is great, and I'm going to have to call her before we wrap this up and see if she can help me out here. But yeah, you got any good mockumentary recommendations in the meantime?
You know, I haven't seen a good one. Back into the okay. So this one though it's a little older, but it's not that older, but it's definitely in relation to what we were just talking about, those weird time stories. Check out Lake Mungo, Mungo, I think it is Mungo. No, it's Australian. Spanish? Australian? I don't know why I'm all confused on this one. I know why. I've smoked a bunch of joints. But it's really good. It's a good one. And it's got a weird, like, time travel-y twist at the end, where it's kind of like the Silver Run tunnel story, A Ghost of the Future. So, yeah, that's a good one. Lake Mungo.
Lake Mungo?
Munga. It's Mungo, I think.
Okay. Okay, so I found this one. It is called Dark Mountain.
And Dark Mountain, okay.
Yeah, I recommend that you watch this ASAP. This is it right here. It's the beginning of it. They go through and they ask people that live in the town about it. And yeah, it's...
Oh, yeah. Look, love it. I always love... because I don't think a found footage ever gets higher than a 6 on the ratings. They always hate found footage movies. And that's how I know I'm going to love it.
Well, let's let me show you. We can put a trailer here. Like this fucking movie sponsoring my damn podcast.
Yeah, fucking Dangerous World. Sponsored by Dark Mountain.
Yeah, dude. Enter
in promo theaters, code, 2013. Enter promo code Danger
for the first 15 minutes free.
Okay, travel yeah, back in time to 2013 and go see it.
A great movie.
A good documentary.
Come on.
When was the last story you heard of people going after the Dutchman?
Not a day goes by, somebody, at least one or more people, are in that mountain looking for the Dutchman's gold. Gold in his mind was so rich, it would make millionaires out of 20 men.
We're on the right track. This is going to be a really amazing trip. I can feel it.
You know, you hear stories of the Superstition Mountains, like
sun,
yeah. People believe in this, what do they call it?
Vortex.
The Apaches considered their thunder god's domain. It was taboo to even go in there.
Yeah, I've heard about the curse, yes.
What have you heard about it?
Well, it seems like everybody that goes looking for the gold ends up missing or dead.
Oh my god!
We're fucked.
There's no such thing as ghosts or curses or spirits, whatever the fuck you want to call it, okay?
Am I the only sane person here?
Just think, man.
I am thinking!
Remember this, once you step off that trail, you're in no man's land.
That looks fun.
Dude, it's great. It was really good. I was pleasantly surprised. I haven't seen a good one of those in a while. It gets a little Blair Witchy towards the end. But it is good. Oh, we're still playing here. Sorry. But yeah, no, it's good stuff. I recommend it to anyone out there, not just you. But yeah,
absolutely.
Phenomenal stuff, man. I'm happy with the stuff that you do, man, and the stuff that you share. It's great stuff. Now, one more time, plug the name of that new book and anything else that you want people to go find you on Instagram, your website, all that stuff.
Yeah, the new book is A Place Between Time and Space. A true story of UFOs, ghosts, and Florida's strangest home. Link in the bio or description of this episode. And then, of course, you can also find that link to the Betts Castle petition. Help save it. Let's get it recognized. I love to do a found footage documentary with the house, maybe as a fundraiser to help raise funds to get it saved.
That'd be great.
The first step to all of that is signing this petition and getting it recognized. So please go sign that. As for me, you can find all of my work at chazofthedead.com, podcast appearances, projects I'm working on, my Patreon, my books, my articles. I write monthly for Paranormality Magazine. Go check out those guys. They published this new book. They're doing awesome stuff over there.
Yeah, he's great.
You can find me on social media at Chaz of the Dead on all the things, the TikToks, the Twitters, the Instagrams. And yeah, thanks for having me on, man.
Of course, dude. It's always a pleasure, man. You always bring some very, very interesting perspective and topics and all the good stuff, man. So yeah, dude, let me know if you ever go to the Superstition Mountains. It's not too terribly far for me. I can maybe make it up there and we can go investigate some shit together. I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I'll just try and learn a thing or two.
Oh man, hell, my investigative equipment. People are, oh, what do you use? Spirit box? Blah blah. Nah, man, my number one piece of equipment is some dude next to me watching all this weird shit happen.
I'm down, like, dude.
I'm not making it up. People know I'm not just spinning a yarn. So that's the key is a second witness.
I'm about it, dude. I'll bring
paranormal
a dog
investigations
too.
Hell yeah, I bring my dog Most places I go to, he's a little scary cat, afraid of his own shadow. No, you know, on investigations, he just sits there. He hangs out. If we're like, if he sees like a statue, though, man, he fucking hates statues. Like, for whatever reason, he can't comprehend a fake thing, you know?
He's I wonder if there's something to the statues that he's afraid of, though.
Who knows? There was one in West Virginia, Point Pleasant, Chief Cornstalk, who supposedly cursed the land. He was really freaked out by that one. Damn, dude. Yeah, did that, not like his statue.
Dude, it is scary when dogs and kids are like looking at something and that you can't see. There's something real freaky about that, man.
Oh yeah, talking to like the vents or something. Oof.
Fuck all that. Yeah, man, always an honor and a true pleasure to talk with you, brother. Have a good one, and I hope that we can get this Betts Castle saved, man. I think it sounds like a big deal with, as you say, spooky Florida, and I think that that's important, man. We need to save that kind of shit.
Absolutely.
So.
Thanks for helping me get the word out.
Of course, man. Anything I can do, and thanks for coming on. And until next time, guys, we will talk to you soon.